of this passage before us. First of all, you should note that Jesus is in Caesarea Philippi. We see that in verse 27. Jesus went out and his disciples into the town, into the towns of Caesarea Philippi. Now, that is kind of odd, because you were wondering why in the world Jesus was up there. That's not a place where any Jews would have been. It's a place, if you look at the map, it's pretty far north. It's above the Sea of Galilee. This was, from what I understand, this was a place where Roman soldiers would have gone on vacation, and you can imagine what that place would have been like. This is not a place where Jews would have inhabited. It seems, and even if you go back to you look through this chapter in Mark 8, it seems like Jesus was trying to get away alone with his disciples. That seems to be the point. This is approximately 6 months before the cross. This is the fall before the spring of his crucifixion. And he has he's trying to get away alone with his disciples. And it's also, the other part of this context that is important is this is right at the time or right after Peter's confession. When, you know, Jesus said, who do men say that I am? And they said, and then who do you say that I am? And Jesus said, Christ, the Son of the living God. It's just after that confession that in verse 31, Jesus began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected of the elders and of the chief priests and scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. This is the first time, at least in as it's recorded in the Gospels, this is the first time in all the ministry that Jesus had with his disciples that he brought up the cross with them. That is, that he was going to die. Now, we're not going to look at the other passages, but clearly the disciples never got this until after the resurrection. They didn't understand. They didn't. You would think, it's almost like they didn't hear him. You would think, because he repeated this several times later on, but this is the first time, you would think that after 3 days, they would have gone, you would have thought that they would have been like hanging out at the tomb, wondering, you know, if he's going to rise again. Because he repeated this several times. He was going to die, and he was going to rise after 3 days. They never got it. They didn't understand it. In their mind, they were still thinking that he was going to conquer the Romans somehow. He was going to bring in the kingdom in a way that they totally misunderstood. They never got it, that Jesus was going to die, that he was going to be killed by the Jewish leaders. But what I want you to observe as we look at verse 34, first of all, that this is a call to salvation. Verse 34 and 35 is not a call, if I can put it this way, it's not a call to discipleship that is different than salvation. By the way, this is kind of what, without going off on that tangent, this is kind of what one of the central points in the whole lordship salvation issue. There are those who would teach that this call of discipleship is separate from a call to salvation. That there was a call to, you know, being saved, and then there was a call to really serious discipleship, and they were two separate things. Well, I firmly believe that this call to discipleship is a call to salvation. Jesus Christ was calling men to salvation. So when he says in verse 34, it says, when he called the disciples unto him with his disciples also, he said unto them, whosoever will come after me. That is the call to salvation. Who will come after me? That's not some extra, you know, beyond redemption. This is the call to redemption. This is the call to repentance. And what I'd like to observe, a couple of things. First of all, notice, this is not a question of someone accepting Jesus. Notice, Jesus puts qualifications on who he will accept. It's not a question of, we often put it that way, will you accept Jesus? Well, that's really not the question. The question is, will Jesus accept you? There are qualifications under which Jesus will accept a man. And these are it. He is laying out a qualification or qualifications for following him, for salvation. This is on the basis on which Jesus will accept a man. I remember some years ago in a Mennonite church, this was kind of it's more to the left of center of evangelicalism. It was a Mennonite church, and the guy got up, and you know, he's kind of like a hippies type college kid playing a guitar, you know? And he sang this song. I think he wrote it, as I recall. And it was a song, he called it, "I'll Shake Your Hand." And it was about how when he would get to glory and he'd meet Jesus, he'd shake his hand. And the implication was that, you know, Jesus, you did a nice job. And it was like, he's got this all in reverse. This is not about Jesus seeking any man's approval. Jesus doesn't need to be accepted by anybody or any man. This isn't about what we think of Jesus. The question of salvation is, what does Jesus think of me? And does he accept me? So it's important to keep that in mind. It is absolutely phenomenal to observe in the Gospels how Jesus dealt with people who wanted to follow him. Jesus was, to put it mildly, generally skeptical of men's adoration. And that's putting it mildly. I want to read to you a list of passages. You're familiar with all of them. But, you know, we get so callous to the Gospels because we know the stories, we read them. But I want you to honestly think about it. It's almost funny sometimes, in a strange sort of way. It is almost funny. Jesus discouraged people from following him. It seems that way. I'm just going to take you to a few passages. Again, you know them, but look at John chapter 2, 23 through 25. This is probably about a year into his ministry. I'll just read it. It says, "Now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover, in the feast day," so he's at Jerusalem, there's probably thousands of people at a feast day, "many believed in his name when they saw the miracles which he did. But Jesus did not commit himself unto them, because he knew all men, and needed not that any should testify of man, for he knew what was in man." He knew, and this was the tenor of most of his ministry, he knew that great crowds would believe on him, would follow him, would lift him up and want to make him king. He knew that the majority of those people who would claim to believe in him were fakes. They weren't really interested in following him. He knew that. He knew that from day one, that the majority of the people who were going to, you know, hail his name and follow him and make a big deal out of him didn't understand and were not truly saved. Look at John chapter 6. Again, another well-known passage. Again, he just in the beginning of the chapter, he had fed 5,000. This crowd followed him, and he gives this long discourse on the bread of life and how he's the bread of life. And basically, and Jesus did this a lot, he put the people in a position where they had to make a choice between their Pharisaical religion and him. And that's really what he does here in John chapter 6. Their only hope of life is him. At the rejection of Pharisaic religion. And by the time he's done with this speech, they all turn around and go. In fact, even some of those who were his disciples left. Look at verse 60. It says, many, therefore, of his disciples, when they heard this, said, this is a hard saying. Who can hear it? When Jesus knew in himself that his disciples murmured at it, he said unto them, does this offend you? Now notice what I find so interesting about Jesus. He's never bothered by the fact that the crowds leave. He's never bothered. In fact, when the crowds come, he usually says something that makes them leave. He doesn't say, hey, wait a minute, guys, let me explain. he says, does this offend you? to his disciples. What and if you shall see the Son of Man ascend up where he was before? It is the Spirit that quickens. The flesh profits nothing. The words that I speak unto you, they are spirit and they are life. But there are some of you that believe not. For Jesus knew from the beginning who they were that believed not and who should betray him. And notice, it didn't bother him. And he said, therefore said I unto you, that no man can come unto me except it were given unto him of my Father. From that time many of his disciples went back and walked no more with him. I mean, he effectively turned a whole group of disciples away from him by hard sayings. Look at Matthew 8. Or no, let's go to John. We're in John. John 12. And again, I like to... This is an odd passage, really. I would have liked to have been there on some of these occasions. This is right before his crucifixion. I mean, Jesus is honestly, he's feeling a very heavy heart because he knows what is before him. This is just before the Passion Week. And he's at the feast, verse 20 of chapter 12, and there were certain Greeks among them that came up to worship at the feast in Jerusalem. The same came to Philip, which was of Bethsaida of Galilee, and desired him, saying, sir, we would see Jesus. Now here's a group of Greeks now, whether they were Jewish, you know, Hellenistic Jews or what God fears, I don't know what they were, but they came up and they wanted to see Jesus. Here were some genuine seekers. You know, they wanted to see Jesus. They wanted to meet him, and these were potential disciples. These were potential followers. Verse 22, Philip comes and tells Andrew, and again Andrew and Philip tell Jesus. So they take this guy to Jesus. And here's what Jesus says. The hour has come that the Son of Man should be glorified. Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abides alone. But if it die, it brings forth much fruit. He that loves his life shall lose it, and he that hates his life in this world shall keep it unto life eternal. If any man serve me, let him follow me. And where I am, there shall also my servant be. If any man serve me, him will my Father honor. Now is my soul troubled. And what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this cause came I unto the Father. Father, glorify thy name. He didn't even really address their question. Look at Matthew 8. Verse 18. Now when Jesus saw great multitudes about him, he gave commandment to depart unto the other side. And a certain scribe came and said unto him, Master, I will follow thee whithersoever thou goest. You know, again, you'd think that Jesus would give him some encouragement here. And Jesus said unto him, the foxes have holes, the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. And another of his disciples said unto him, Lord, suffer me first to go and bury my father. And I'm assuming there, not that the father died, but that he was waiting till his father would die, so he could get the inheritance. But Jesus said unto him, follow me and let the dead bury their dead. Jesus just was not, quite frankly, very interested in what people's issues were. He knew that the majority of the people who came to him were not sincere. They were not true followers. And he made no attempt whatsoever to change their mind. He made no attempt whatsoever to convince them. He made no attempt to, you know, to draw them or to somehow make it more appealing or make them feel good or tell. He was so, if I can put it, he was blunt. Look at Luke 14. I really like this one. This is not the way to like impress a crowd. This is not the way to make people feel good or make them want to follow you. Verse 25, and there went great multitudes with him. So there's this great multitude following him, which is often the case. And he turned and said unto them, and this is how he starts his speech, if any man come to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, in his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. How many followers is he going to get? That's a pretty strong statement. That was not intended to like draw as many possible people to follow him. When Jesus spoke to the multitudes, he spoke in such a way that he was trying to separate the men from the boys, so to speak. Those who were going to follow and those who weren't. He wasn't interested in half-hearted or he wasn't interested in large multitudes of people. He was only interested in those he knew the Father had given him. And he knew that the ones that the Father had given him would follow at any price. And that's what he was trying to determine. This was not a popularity thing. Now contrast this, I couldn't help but think of this, and sorry, but contrast this to what Rick Warren wrote in his Purpose-Driven Church. This is what he wrote. It is my deep conviction that anybody can be won to Christ if you discover the key to his or her heart. Well, quite frankly, Jesus must have been awfully poor at discovering the keys to people's hearts. Because most of the people that Jesus dealt with turned away. Now that's sobering. It really is. This is a call to salvation and not many people respond. Why? Because of the condition. What's the condition Jesus lays out? Death. Mark. Going back to Mark chapter 8 where we began. That's the condition. If Jesus lays out one condition for salvation and to follow him, it's death. Unconditional, complete, end of story, death. Whosoever will come after me, let him, three things, deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Those are the three conditions. I'd say that's pretty complete. And I'll just say a little bit here. Deny, there are the three words there, deny, the three verbs, deny, they're all in the imperative. That is, they're all commands. Let him. Deny himself is in the aorist tense. Take up his cross is in the aorist tense. Follow me is in the present tense. Now, why is that significant? Usually when, maybe the best way to say it is present tense usually implies continued, you know, a continual action. The idea of not stopping. Aorist tense usually has the idea of a, I don't want to say once and done, but it's the idea more of a point in time. And I think the point is that, generally speaking, at the point of salvation, a Christian, a man, takes up his cross and denies himself. And then the rest of his life is following. Following him, having taken up his cross, having died or denied himself. I just want to look at a couple of these things, or just say a couple of things about each one of these verbs. So idea of deny himself. What does it mean to deny oneself? It does not mean to deny oneself pleasures or things. It's not speaking of asceticism. It's not It's not denial in that sense. It's a complete denial of self. One commentator compared it to what Peter did when he denied Christ. And he said, I don't know the man. He swore, I don't know the man. I never, you know. And that's in essence what we do when we deny ourselves. We turn our backs on ourselves. I don't know the man. It's not about me. It's total denial of self. Self is no longer the issue. You see, it's the complete opposite of pride, which is self-exaltation, which we looked at last week. It is the complete opposite of self-exaltation. It is a complete denial of self. Take up his cross. Well, again, certainly he had in view here when he said this, his own death. And I think maybe we don't appreciate probably today the shame and the lowliness of the cross in the way that people did in the age of this, when the Bible was written or when Paul preached. Because the cross was a horrible symbol. I mean, you wouldn't have found people wearing it as jewelry in the Roman days. I mean, it was something people didn't talk about. It was the death penalty. It was an ugly, excruciating way to die, and it was a horrible statement. You didn't talk about crosses, and you certainly didn't glory in a cross. But Jesus said that if any man would follow him, he must take up his cross. And the bottom line is, it's death. It is absolute, unconditional death. It's death to me. That is step one in the Christian life. This isn't like something you do down the road. This isn't like some point of rededication in your life. This is salvation. Salvation is death. And there is no life apart from death. This is the part of the gospel that has been totally left out. Listen, if we would write books about dying, they wouldn't sell. Because that's not what people want to hear. What concerns me the most about some of the books that are written today is not what is said, it's what's not said. The cross is left out. You can't be saved without dying. Without complete death to yourself. There is no salvation any other way. I mean, we say it over and over again. You know, baptism doesn't save you. Being involved in a church doesn't save you. Being a part of this church doesn't save you. Being a nice person doesn't save you. There is only one avenue to salvation, and it's through death. Complete, unquestionable, undeniable, complete death. That's not a popular message. That's the gospel. And then, having taken up our cross, having denied ourselves, now we're in a position we can follow. Follow me. That's the rest of your life. That's the rest of your story. That's it. It's no longer deemed good. It's Christ. I am dead to sin. I am dead to me. I'm dead to anything about me. I am now following Christ. And you cannot follow Christ without the first. Listen, we live in an age where everybody is following Christ. Everyone believes in Jesus. Everyone loves Jesus. But they skipped the first step. And the problem isn't that the people aren't accepting Jesus. The problem is Jesus isn't accepting them. Because they haven't died. And the reason I bring this up most fundamentally in a discussion about walking with God is that I am convinced that in many churches, people are trying to live the Christian life who haven't died. They still aren't dead. And you can't live until you die. Am I being too harsh? Well, I should say a couple things about what it doesn't mean to die to ourselves, and a couple things about what it does mean. First of all, it doesn't mean, when we say that we die to ourselves, it does not mean that we don't take care of ourselves. I mean, I suppose if we were really absurd, we could say that. It doesn't mean I guess I could say, well, if I'm dead to myself, I won't even care how I look, I won't comb my hair, I won't take a shower, I won't care how I dress. That's not what it means to die to self. Dying to ourselves does not mean we don't take care of ourselves. It doesn't mean that we don't take care of our bodies. I think, to be honest with you, I think a lot of men in the past in church history made big mistakes in this regard. Guys who literally, they didn't take care of their bodies. They didn't sleep. They would work themselves to death, and they died young. A lot of these, you read about some of these men, they were very prolific, but they died when they were 40 or 30 because they worked so hard, they didn't take care of themselves. I don't think that is what it means to die to ourselves. We ought to take care of our bodies. We ought to take care of ourselves. God's called us. That's part of being a steward. It doesn't mean that I don't care about money or things like that. I mean, it doesn't mean I don't live with wisdom. That's not what it means. It doesn't mean we become a monk. It doesn't mean we go sell all our stuff and give to the poor and then we go live like a monk. That's not what dying to ourselves means. It doesn't mean we become ascetics, that we refuse pleasure just for the sake of refusing pleasure. That's not death to self. And when you read church history, or quite frankly, you can look at people today, people have often mistaken those things for death to self. And they try to work it themselves. See, I'm going to die to myself. I'm going to refuse myself every pleasure. I'm going to be an ascetic. Well, that's silly. That's not death to self. That's nothing more than self-righteousness. That is not death to self. What is death to self? What it does mean? Well, I guess it means a lot of things, but number one, it means I'm no longer the issue. Period. It's never about what people think about me. It's never whether someone offends me, meets my needs, deals with my problems. It is never about me. Because I'm dead. Listen, when I hear people complain about things like, well, so-and-so, they did this to me, and so-and-so did that to me, aren't you dead? Well, why do you care? Does it really bother you that much that people talk about you behind your back? Does it really bother you that people don't like the way you do something? Why? Aren't you dead? Oh, so-and-so is not meeting my needs. Aren't you dead? It's not about me anymore. It's not about my needs being met. It's not about me and fulfilling my dreams. It's not about people loving me or caring about me. It's not about people saying nice things about me. Because I'm dead. People can glorify me, or they can ignore me, or they can hate me. I don't care. Because I'm dead. It doesn't matter. That's what it means to be dead. And when people, and you see this so much in counseling today, it's all about so-and-so's not meeting my needs. So-and-so's not... The first thing you need to do as a counselor is say, look, die. People will say, and I've heard this often, people will say, well, you wouldn't expect me to remain in an unhappy marriage, would you? God wouldn't expect me to be unhappy, would he? He wouldn't, huh? Aren't you dead? That's one reason there's so many divorces, because people are under the impression, the false impression, that God is more concerned about me being happy than me keeping his law. Look, I'm dead. If for the glory of God I have to suffer a horrible marriage with someone who doesn't love me, for God's glory, I will do it. Why? Because I'm dead. It's not about me anymore. It's not about what people do to me or don't do for me. I'm dead. And the converse of that is, I live for the glory of God. Now, everything I do is for the glory of God. There is nothing outside of that. And it's not so much that when we die, we change our vocation or we change our doesn't mean we sell our house and go live like a monk. That's not the point. The point is, everything I do is now for the glory of God. Kevin was out playing golf this afternoon. You know, he could do that for the glory of God. It's true. Everything you do, you can do for the glory of God. Now, if I'm truly doing it for the glory of God, I'm not going to get angry when I don't do well, which is usually the case when I go out. It's a good lesson in patience. But listen, I don't care what your recreation is. I don't care what your occupation is, unless it's immoral, of course. I don't care what you do from day to day, getting up in the morning, going to bed at night, brushing your teeth, eating. Whatever you do for the glory of God now. Now that answers an awful lot of problems that we deal with in counseling. It is all for the glory of God. And I would ask you this question, and this is really, in my mind, telling. Is there anything, and I mean anything or anyone, in your life that you hold on to before God? The person who has died has nothing they hold on to. Everything, and I mean everything, is held with an open hand. Your family, your house, your business, your health, every single thing is held with an open hand. God, it's yours. You do with it what you will. Why? Because I'm dead. And I live for the glory of God. And whether I'm healthy or sick, whether I'm rich or poor, if it means being single for the rest of my life, if whatever it is. Now, I do not mean by that when God takes those things, that it's not painful. Even though we're dead, it doesn't mean we don't have feelings. It doesn't mean that even though I might hold my family very dear and I hold them with an open hand, it doesn't mean that if I lose them that it's not painful. It's still painful. And this is very personal, but it's inward. Do you hold on? Or have you let go? And believe me, if you have let go, you know it. And this is really the place of suffering oftentimes in the Christian life. It really tests us. Have we let go? And suffering can come in lots of different ways. And sometimes, it just does. It comes in totally different ways for different people. And sometimes it's very obvious what it is, and sometimes it's not. But those tests often very quickly display whether or not you've let go, whether or not you are truly dead. And often what happens with tests is they again, I'm not saying that it's an easy thing or that it's just, you know, no emotion involved. But what happens when the test comes, oftentimes, usually people will go one way or the other. They will turn from the faith or they will be changed. But listen, it's all a question of this. Are you dead? Have you died? And if you have died, then you can live. And this is, in conclusion here, this is really the fundamental starting point for Christian living. I find it interesting that the very first command in the book of Romans is Romans 6, verse 11, the first verb that is an imperative, reckon. Reckon yourself dead to sin and alive to God. Listen, you don't go around trying to overcome your old nature or reforming it. You reckon yourself dead to it. You reckon yourself dead to sin and alive to God. Because we're dead. We are dead, now reckon it so. Reckon yourself dead. That is the way of the cross. It's not a popular way. But it's a little bit, if I could use a rather general illustration, it's a little bit like, I love trails. And I'm the kind that once I start down a trail, it's very hard for me to turn around. But imagine two trails that one at the outset just looks absolutely perfect. It looks like it's going to lead to just a wonderful life, a perfect, you know, everything right. And then imagine one that's kind of dark and dingy and looks like it'd be the last place you'd want to go. That's the starting point. The way of the cross looks discouraging. It looks like a trail nobody would want to take in their right mind, which is the reason almost nobody takes it. Most people go in this trail because it looks rosy. It looks exactly like what I'd want to do. And the problem is, as you go down that trail, it gets harder and harder and harder and harder. But if you take this trail, you'll find that once you start on the trail, it gets easier and easier and easier. And it is an absolute blessing. Why? Because you die. Think about it. If you die to yourself, it is such a relief. It is such a joy. Now, nothing anybody can do to you can affect your joy. Nothing anybody or anything that happens to you can affect you. Why? Because you're dead. It's the way to life. That is the way of the cross. Let's pray. Lord, the way of the cross is not popular. But I do pray that each one of us here would take that way, for it is the way to life. Lord, it's a very personal thing. Nobody can really know except for themselves whether or not they have died. Lord, I pray that you would work in us this death and that we would reckon ourselves dead to sin in order that we might reckon ourselves alive unto you, and that is true life. To be servants of righteousness, to be servants of the Lord, is true freedom. And truly, the only true life. I pray, Lord, that as we go from here, that we would reckon ourselves dead to ourselves, dead to sin, dead to the world, dead to temptation, and alive unto you. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Let us close.